Today on The Grave Talks, part two of our conversation with Dylan Jones about studying parapsychology. And going back to your law enforcement days, just out of curiosity, did you ever have any, especially from where you lived in Wales, in such a rich history there, that I just assume there's lots of paranormal activity everywhere you go. but did you ever have any calls or places or times when your interest in the paranormal and law enforcement kind of came together? Like you went out on a call and you're like, I don't know. There's nobody in your house. I don't know what you heard walking around. Did you ever have any calls like that?
Most definitely. I can recall one, and I think it was probably around 1999, and I'd been in the job for about 4 years. I was working a morning shift, and I was sat in the briefing room in the police station when, over my radio, the control room said, we've got this call, this man in the nearby village from where I worked. He's in bed, and he's seen a figure walk through the one wall across his bedroom and disappear through the opposite wall. I looked at my sergeant. I said, oh, Sarge, can I go and take a look? And my sergeant's like, no, it's not a police matter. That's it. We don't deal with stuff like that. I was so disappointed because, you know, it might have been that, thinking of non-paranormal reasons, that this gentleman, you know, might have required support from another agency.
It could be a mental health issue.
Exactly. But I was very well aware of colleagues who reported things. There was one police station in my area, which was an older police station, and they would regularly report the sounds of footsteps upstairs. And some of the police officers would not venture in there after dark because of what they'd heard. There was one occasion where I was working a night shift, and two police officers from British Transport Police contacted us and said, are you available for a meeting in the next half an hour? And we were like, yes, of course, what's wrong? And they said, well, we'll discuss it when we get to the station. And when they got there, they said, look, have you had any reports of something unusual on the main road between these two locations? And I said, no, not that I'm aware of. And they said, well, we were driving up here last night, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and there was nobody else on the road. And we saw this person walk from one side of the road, but then this person walked through the central reservation barrier and disappeared in front of the police car. And we were like, well, we've never heard this before, but interestingly, last week in that exact spot, there was a fatal road traffic collision. So we were just left again with, this is what happened. They were two credible witnesses. They had their experience, but there's nothing else we could add to it at that time. And that wasn't unusual. I had other police colleagues that experienced things in other parts of the area where I worked. And it's the same with nurses and doctors. I've had several of them.
Right.
Tell me about experiences in hospitals.
Yes, because I recently did a story on our other program, Real Ghost Stories Online, where a nurse had, it was an experience that she had had, but she had said most everyone she's worked with has had some sort of paranormal experience, that something has happened, because you're working around so much death and in a location where there's been a lot of death. And I could see, I don't know how any of this works, but I could see how when someone crosses over, there's a little confusion there maybe for a little bit, or maybe quite a while, that what has happened to me? I don't know. Am I here? Am I there? So I don't know if that has something to do with it. It's just, I would love at some point for Dylan, for you to figure this all out.
If I did, I think I'd be a very rich man, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think any findings we do make are going to be small and incremental, that will eventually one day add to more human understanding. And whether that's, you know, that ghosts are spirits of the dead, or whether or not they're just some form of consciousness that survived, or whether it's parallel dimensions, or whether it's all just hallucinations. You know, we have to keep an open mind as to what these experiences are. not go in with confirmation bias and say, you know, all these ghost sightings are spirits of the dead. We just don't know.
So when you're doing your research, I'm assuming it's called a dissertation there. I'm not sure.
It's a thesis.
A thesis. Okay.
Yeah. It's 100,000 words.
Ooh, that's a lot of words.
Yeah.
That's a lot of research.
Yeah. Which is something that, you know, to get the doctorate, you have to be, you know, committed. I mean, I'm doing mine over a period of 5 to 6 years. And I've had to do a lot of reading, a lot of research, a lot of spending time with people, a lot of interviewing. And now I'm onto the pulling the data together to see what I can get from it. So that gets you, well, that gets me, hopefully, the doctorate once it's submitted and I have the Viva interview with two external examiners. What I'm concerned about, and I touched upon it earlier on, there are places online in the US where people pay a certain amount of money and then think that they can use the either doctor or have PhD after their names. And when I've asked them to share their thesis with me, they've not, because it doesn't exist. And I think falsely claiming that somebody has a PhD, it's not illegal unless you're claiming to be a medical doctor. But for me, that's cause of concern in the paranormal area, that people are saying, oh, I'm so-and-so, so-and-so PhD, or I'm Dr. So-and-so, and I'm a parapsychologist. You have to be in an academic setting to be able to use that. So that's something that one of the things I've found out through the research is that sadly there are these people who are doing that, and I think it needs to be stopped.
Well, I guess it goes back to money will buy you anything, or you can just say anything and people believe you.
Yeah.
There aren't that many locations that even offer a doctorate in parapsychology.
No, definitely not. And the thing is, what you're going to be doing is you have a particular area. Mine is primarily within culture. So it's anthropology, sociology, and media effects. That's looking at within an area of parapsychology. My colleague Steve Parsons is doing his in physics, but he's looking at infrasound in haunted locations. My colleague Anne Winsper, she got her doctorate, I think about 2 years ago now. She was looking at the psychology of electronic voice phenomena. You can't go to a university and say, I want to see if ghosts exist, and that's my PhD. You have to use your particular area, whether it's psychology, physics, anthropology, or whatever, and use the parapsychology, which is a multidisciplinary field, then as the sort of background to it.
Now, the one that you just mentioned about EVPs, that's interesting to me because we've all heard an EVP.
Yes.
We've heard something that can't explain. And a lot of people, including myself, have heard voices when there's no one there. I don't know what that is. I've heard people call my name. I heard someone call my dog's name. I've heard people talking. And I don't know what that is because I can't find the source of it. Now, that doesn't prove that it happened. To me, it did because I can say without a doubt, I heard somebody call my name. Definitely. But I can't prove it. And so these EVPs, a lot of times that I hear that people have gotten when they're doing an investigation, they've recorded it. I don't even know that that necessarily proves anything because it could be any number of things. It could have been caused by this or this or this. So how is her approach to an EVP with her area of study? How's she able to approach that?
I mean, what Anne did was a fascinating piece of research. So she's looking at it from a psychological perspective. And the people who gather EVPs, is there a certain kind of personality, perhaps who are more likely to hear what they think is speech when it's just random noise? So, I mean, I'll certainly provide you with Anne's details because I think she would make a fantastic guest.
I'd love to talk to her about that.
As with Steve Parsons, again, he's another one from the physics perspective and sound. You know, I think it'd be best place for Anne to answer that question.
I would love to talk to her about that. EVPs, I find so fascinating.
It's a fascinating area of research, but I'm like you. I don't go gathering EVP, but I've been present when people have caught what they believe is speech on there. I've heard some examples of EVP which I don't hear it as speech, but I've heard others which sound very clear. So it is a fascinating area of research on its own. I would never use it to try and investigate a ghost or haunting because it's subjective, it's not objective data.
And so often with an EVP, I think we talked about this in the episode we did the other day, is I really don't like it when they say, here's the EVP, and then they put up what it says. I want to hear it for myself and decide what I think it says. And then when I'm told what it says, I listen to it all differently. You know,
Yes,
then that's what I'm listening for is get out. And now I have heard some that clear as day you hear get out. And there was one that I, in an episode we did, Apex Paranormal, and they're out, excuse me, out of the Kansas City area. He played an EVP that as soon, the second he played it, I got the biggest chills all down my body. There was something so creepy about that to me. I don't know why I had such a physical reaction to it, but I did. And it just sounded so horrible. Like it was something kind of otherworldly to me. I don't know what it was about it. So I just think there is a difference too when he just played it for me and I was able to experience it. I don't know why I reacted the way I did.
I mean, it's one of those things because it makes it more personal when somebody gets that kind of thing. But when we go along afterwards to try and understand what's gone on, it's interesting to find out, what device they've used to record it on, what microphone did they use? So getting that understanding of the equipment, have they put the file through some form of audio program to enhance it? What alterations have they made? Because that could also have some influence on what's actually perceived to be being heard. Ghost hunters, a lot of the time, like to try and do their own analysis of their evidence, putting the pictures through Photoshop, adjusting things. And you might just be uncovering just, artifacts within the photo, which are already there, but they put an interpretation on it. And the same can be done with EVP. So we need to know later on what they're actually doing, what process they've undertaken to try and get those results, and how they've interpreted it, because that might say more about them rather than what they've actually recorded.
And with your area of study, your thesis exploring the media influences and the practices that people employ these days, it seems to me that everything can be faked. I think we almost live in a society nowadays where it's so easy, you know, an AI person can be on the radio. You don't know that's not a real person. It sounds like a real person, but it's not a real person. And with Photoshop and with everything, you can kind of fake results. So is that kind of hard to sift through things? Do you see things that you go, oh, fake, 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 fake? I've maybe seen that created by an app before. I just think that would be hard. You know, here they're presenting, this is the evidence that we found. How hard is it to decipher what's real and what's not?
Very much so. We need to bear that in mind today, just as we did when Mumler first created, spirit photography.
True.
Where people have added things to photographs, to video, but now it is so much more easier and accessible to do it from the palm of our hand. Bridget and I were stopped on one of her ghost tours, after we'd finished by one of the guests, and he wanted to share with us this picture that he had taken the night before. And he was adamant that, this was a ghost that he had got in this particular location. And we gave him, 5, 10 minutes of our time, allowed him to talk us through it and show us. And when he left, Bridget turned to me and said, God, that was an interesting photograph. And I was like, yes, it was from an app. And she went, well, really? I said, yeah, I've seen it before. I've seen that particular figure used in an app. So this guy was either an incredibly good actor, or he had been fooling himself into believing that what he had obtained was actually a ghost on camera. We need to be, you know, and you've mentioned AI, we just need to be so careful about what we're getting nowadays. That has always got to be in the back of our minds.
Does it make it harder for you to do your research?
Fraud, whether willful or otherwise, has always been something to consider in an investigation. But now it's more to the forefront, I think, than ever before.
When you go out with paranormal investigators, is it kind of like you just observing what they're doing? Because you certainly don't want to influence anything they're doing.
No, I mean, and the very fact that I was there could have influenced the way that they behaved. You know, would they have altered their behavior in front of me, knowing what I was doing? Because some of the research I did, or most of it, was overt, so the people knew why I was there. But I did do some covert ones as well, where I just turned up as part and parcel of what was going on and just observed. The results have been consistent across. You know, I don't think the behavior altered that much, if at all, from the ones who knew why I was there to the ones who didn't. So it's interesting watching them when they work and how they work. It's very revealing about their procedures, their approach, their beliefs, and how those things all come through into what they do.
Do you feel like the media has influenced how people approach it? And by media, I would think that would include all of these television programs are watching about it, YouTube, you know, they went to this location and here's all the things that happened to them that night. Where's the nights where nothing happened? You know, there has to be nights like that. It doesn't make entertaining television, but I do think that makes it more real.
I think very much that a lot of them, that there is some form of media influence. It's perhaps not as obvious and as blatant as what some people would have you believe. I think it's more of a nuanced thing. A lot of the ghost hunters that I've spoken to that used to watch the ghost hunting TV shows, none of them had good things to say about the main ones, particularly a certain one that fronts Ghost Adventures. They were very critical of those shows. And they're often at pains to say, oh, we're not like Ghost Adventures or Most Haunted or any other show. They mostly don't read, as I've said before. There is more of an influence, I think, on social media and being driven by social media content, and whether that's equipment that is now available. But ghost hunters primarily seem to talk to each other. So to teach themselves what to do, they think that just by Googling something, that then gives them, oh, we know what to do now. I spoke to one investigator a few months ago, and I asked about a particular piece of equipment that they were using and how they knew it did this particular thing. And the response was, oh, I just Googled it.
Rather than knowing exactly how that piece of equipment works, they're just taking the word from someone else.
I mean, I had one investigation I observed where the investigator used a Wimshurst machine, which is an electrostatic generator. And it did feature on an episode of 28 Days Haunted on Netflix. And the words of the investigator when I was observing them were, oh, if you use this, it'll make the ghosts appear. You've got to, you know, you're filling the air with electrostatic energy, it makes the ghosts appear. It didn't seem to work that night. But these are the practices that may well have been influenced that they have seen on TV. And they think, oh, yeah, we can use that. We've got a piece of equipment. It looks scientific. Well, it is a piece of scientific equipment. But the reason they're using it is now become pseudoscience.
What kind of evidence would someone have to capture? And maybe you were in the investigation observing or something. But what would be a piece of evidence that you would say, this is really good?
I think it would be something that it's objectively verifiable that the data, that you've used the right equipment, which is meant to do the right job, and you have supporting witnesses or documentation that supports whatever it is that's being claimed. So, you know, you have good witness testimony that has been obtained. If you have video footage or photography or audio recording or temperature data, as long as it's been, you know, recorded accurately, correctly, and interpreted by the data, by the person who's qualified to do it, I think that would be good. But I don't think we're anywhere near close to that yet.
Because like I said earlier, I think so much of this is anecdotal. Anecdotal doesn't mean it didn't happen to me, but I can't prove that it happened to me, you know?
Yeah. It's funny. A friend and colleague of mine, a gentleman by the name of Alan Murdy, he's a prominent investigator from the UK. He's a lawyer, an author, and he's involved with both the SPR and the Ghost Club and ASAP. He's a really, really lovely guy, a really clever man. And he was doing a talk the one day, and he was on about the term that's often used about, you know, to make, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. But he said, I'm putting my lawyer's hat on. There is no such thing as extraordinary proof. You know, you either have evidence of something that happened or you didn't. It doesn't have to be extraordinary. You just provide evidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you had three witnesses in a court of law that said, I saw somebody, this person, steal this item at this time in this place, the chances are that a jury would accept that. If you had those three people saying, I saw a ghost at this time in this place, what would they say?
Right. And I do think, though, even in the scenario where they saw somebody stealing something, you could also, those three witnesses might describe that person differently.
Oh, yes.
You know, he had blonde hair, he had brown hair, he was about 5'10", he was 5'5". You know, they can also remember it much differently.
Yeah. And in fact, having been a police officer, I've had those situations where people who are on the surface reputable, very good witnesses, they will still observe different things and interpret the events in a very different way. So I was doing a ghost hunters training session back in, I'd say about 2005, and it was at this very old haunted house in South Wales. So I took a group of 10 people who wanted to be, you know, ghost hunters across to this old mansion house that was built in the 1600s, and they want, you know, to see how good a witness they actually were. And we walked into the house and I said, right, come on, we're going to walk straight back to the classroom where we're doing the training. As you walked into the house, you walked past one of the living history interpreters that were there. I'd like you to describe that person. And they were like, oh, right. So they all got to, they all separately wrote down a description, and there were 10 different descriptions of this person. Some got certain things, some got others, some got things wrong. And it was fascinating that this is what witnesses are like. But they all definitely saw the very real person that was a living history interpreter. They all definitely had this experience of seeing this person, but their evidence was all different. And I think we have to remember that humans are infallible. And I'm not saying I'm any better than any others. People think, oh, you're a police officer, you're an excellent witness. We're all human. We all make mistakes. We're all fallible. We look at things through our own lens, our own interpretation. So it's just something very important to bear in mind, that people say, I know what I saw. And you know what you saw, but then you interpreted it based on your life experience and all the conditions at that particular time.
With your personal experiences and your professional experiences, your area of study, if I was to put you on the scale from believer, skeptic, non-believer, where would you kind of fall?
Skeptic.
Skeptic?
Yeah.
That was going to be my guess.
And I think it's not a bad word. I think people see skeptical believer. You need to find skeptic. Being a skeptic is a good thing. It's being a cynic that is not. A skeptic will be open-minded. A skeptic would be somebody who is open to that as being one of the possibilities, but will still want to ask lots of questions to try and get to the very heart of what went on that's going to add to the weight of human understanding. That's mm-hmm. that's all we do, what we do. We know people have unusual experiences, but we also have to be mindful that people make mistakes, people lie, but we also know that there are people who tell the truth. So mm-hmm. we have to be in the middle of all of this and taking an objective view about what's going on.
And I do think it's interesting that you and your fiance Bridget, who owns the Witching Hour Paranormal Ghost Tours in Savannah, like you two are very different, but that balances each other out, I would think, too.
It does.
You know, I think she has some unique abilities and you kind of balance that out.
We do. And we have this mutual respect for each other's position. And we joke about it with each other, you know, even on the tours about, you know, she calls me her Debbie Downer, that I'm always the one with taking that step back. And it's like, well, that is my job. I have got, you know, I have to look at whether or not that person is, you know, mistaken or not telling perhaps 100% of the truth or misinterpreting something. Because if we don't, we could allow ourselves to believe absolutely anything that people tell us, and look back at history at where that's got us.
Well, and even currently in history, there are just untruths yes. going around and people believe them yeah. without yeah. looking at it with that critical eye. And I think that's very important, especially when it comes to this field. I think a lot of us have had paranormal experiences, period. How you prove it, I don't know. But I also think it's important to look at it with that critical eye and see if there's an explanation for it first.
Very much so.
It has been a really fun conversation with you today. I have really enjoyed this.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's nice to be able to talk with somebody who's asking these really searching questions, wanting to understand more, and then being given the opportunity to be able to answer them fully with somebody as well. Because what I'm passionate about is getting people to embrace the subject, take the subject area seriously, and then learn from what's going on and about how they can enrich their own lives and approach to ghost hunting.
You know, if somebody's interested in doing some paranormal investigations, I think it's really important to learn from someone who has some good experiences and some good abilities to teach you how to do it correctly.
One of the things that we do, like when Bridget does on the Witching Hour, she gives out the equipment, but then I'm there to give the counter view as to, well, this is being used, this is what you see on TV, but you know, this is the K2 meter, and I will go over some of the things that we've discussed this afternoon. It's giving people more access to information that they might not previously have had.
And I think the information is important. And this is why you're using this piece of equipment. This is what you could possibly get from it. Here's what it means. And to do some research and know what that equipment does and why it's picking up what it might be picking up is important. Yeah. Now, so somebody might take a tour and actually meet you on the tour. That yes. would be cool. And Bridget, she is really nice. I really enjoyed talking to you both the other day. And then there's also a website that I found that people can go to get more information as well. And it was the Ghost Hunter website.
Yes, so it's theghosthunter.co.uk. So if they go to that, they will find out more information about me, about my colleagues that I've mentioned, Steve Parsons and Anne Winsper, and also access to the book Ghostology that was spoken about. So you can do that. Or if they want to see something else, they can also look up the Society for Psychical Research, which is spr.ac.uk.
Well, this has been so interesting today. And thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I hope you're going to come and see us in Savannah.
Oh, I want to so bad. That is on my bucket list, I am telling you. So yes, I will definitely be there and I will definitely take a tour with you guys. That would be so fun.
That would be awesome.
And that wraps up our conversation with Dylan Jones. You can get more information about Dylan at theghosthunter.co.uk, or you can join Dylan and his fiance Bridget on a ghost tour of Savannah. Visit that website at witchinghoursavannah.com. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, that includes the archive and advanced episodes, you'll get everything commercial free. Become a Gravekeeper. You can sign up today at Apple Podcasts, where you can try it for 3 days free, or you can also go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us here at The Grave Talks, thank you very much for listening.